come only from the quizzes. When I made the final, I didn't have some of the quizzes, so. But it does come from all the homework, okay? Yeah. Huh? Did it work out that way by accident? No, I didn't work off that, because it didn't work. Okay. The file didn't work. Okay. Anyway, there'll be some excitement on the final. And the purpose of the final is not to trick you. I mean, the average grade on the final is something like 99.5 or something. So don't worry and don't put it off. You'll get like a 98, okay, if you don't study. And just do it. I taught for 10 years in New York, more than 10 years, and didn't do finals. And no one learned almost anything. And when I started to do finals, people really learned things. And you only learn on the last day, I know that. that's why I always come in late, because it doubles your learning time. And it works. It really does work. I mean, people in these classes, you really are learning the important elements. When I went to do my Geshe exams, it was 7 days of debating. 15 people here came with me, and it was just a good time. We just had a good time because everything in the exam was in the courses. And they said, "How come you're so well prepared?" I said, "I've just been teaching the courses. I didn't study." And so really you are learning the essence of what they study in the monastery, and you really are learning the essence of what a Geshe studies. And it's not my purpose to try to trick you or something like that. I just want you to know the important things and not forget them, especially because you have to pass it on to other people. Okay? So, we'll go through real quick. I used to call on people. Maybe I will. Okay. It's very embarrassing, okay? So have all your notes in front of you. Okay. First question is, what's the name of the book, okay, that you're studying? And the only comment I have there is, don't forget to say Master Shantideva. You know, I've caught myself a lot saying Tongkhapa, which is very improper. And I was reminded by my eminent students that it's Jetsongkhapa and Master Shantideva, okay? And that's the only thing I think you should be careful not to miss that. His dates are about 700 AD. We don't know for sure. You should know who wrote the commentary and what's the name of the commentary that we studied. By the way, we really, really worked hard. I mean, I don't think the people working on the text didn't get more than a couple hours of sleep the last few days, but we just could not finish. So we're going to mail you the last three readings, okay? Anybody who came to the first few classes and got on the list is going to get mailed the readings. If you didn't have your name on that list, you might want to tell John Stillwell. And while I'm thinking about it, I wanted to thank everybody who worked hard on getting these things ready. And I'll name a few and I'll forget somebody and don't mind. I know John ran around last fall looking for places to have the class and worked really hard to prepare everything and worked really hard to get us to be efficient, which is very difficult. And I'd like to thank him for that. Sometimes I think he's an emanation of Drumtenje, who was the facilitator when Atisha was trying to get into Tibet. And Drumtenje never took vows, never became a monk, but ended up building Rodring Monastery and stuff like that. Get it? Okay. I know Mary Oberdorf's been doing all the correspondence courses and a lot of work. And that's been very nice. Judy Hummel doing all the finances to finance this thing. And that's a lot of work. And it's a lot of work to keep all the to juggle all the finances to keep the books going and things like that and get the places paid, and she's been doing that very nice. Margie, who's kindly been driving me back and forth to New Jersey so I can get here on time and get home on time. Prinzo has been grading almost all the papers with a little help from Jimba. Really working hard on that. It's a lot. It takes a lot of time to do it nicely. Elizabeth and Aura spent hundreds of hours on the reading. I don't do the dirty work anymore of inserting the Tibetan and breaking it up and cleaning it up and everything. They do that. So Tassie's been a great help with the extension courses, getting me in and out of obscure towns. Sometimes I feel like an old rock band or something. Anyway, okay. Did I miss anybody? No. Okay. Well, needless to say, Winston, who ran away to get an award tonight, and there have been a few. Are they anonymous? Do they mind? No. John Brady's helped a lot financially. There's a lot of financial help coming in to pay for all the course materials. Okay, and that's why we can still do it for free. And I really would like to continue to do it for free. And so I want to thank Winston. Winston gave a nice donation, and Brady and some other people. Oh, I never see these guys because I always come later. But Hector's been working hard. Scott and Luis, right? To hand out the... And? Yeah, okay. So I like that. Anyway, thank you for that. Chilton's been helping too. I don't know. He's out packing. Okay. You should know the structure of the Bodhisattva Charyavatara. Okay. The structure of the various chapters. What's the first chapter? Depends on the... Okay, we'll skip that. let's do it generally. What's the first chapter? Oh boy. Huh? Huh? Benefits of bodhicitta. Like, supposedly, I think you've been following, you're following the book, and at some point you actually take the vow. You know, you take the vow like you did. So first, the first thing Master Shantideva has to do is to sell you on the idea of taking the vow. And he's trying to describe the great benefit of bodhicitta. So that was the first chapter. Second chapter? I have the answers. Purifying bad deeds, which is half of the preparation for taking the vows. You have to clean up your mental continuum before the vows can fit in. And there were some little preliminaries before that. I think it was three. What were those? Before you actually do the purification, you have to do three other things. Prostrate, make offerings. What was the third one? Taking refuge. Okay, I mean, those three things are counted in with purification. Okay, purifying yourself before you take the vows. Bowing down to holy beings, which means they're there. Taking refuge in them. And understanding why they can protect you. Okay, it's not just pictures that you're bowing down to some picture. The picture can't help you. Okay, even the thing which the picture represents can't help you in the normal way of thinking. You could be standing next to the Buddha and someone could be attacking you and you would probably still die. Okay, and that's not the way they can protect you. Okay, and then offering, and we went through the different kinds of offering before you do purification. Third chapter? Yeah, third chapter is called Acquiring the Wish, and it referred to actually getting it in your heart and also taking the various vows. Okay? There's two kinds of commitments. What? One is to the wish. One is a commitment to the wish. And then the second one is a commitment to act like a bodhisattva. We went over the wish in detail. The commitment to act like a bodhisattva has like 64 vows, and we didn't go into that much. We did a whole class on it, right? So you guys are expert about that. And inside of there was another subject. Like you finish the purification, but you still have to do what? You still have to collect some positive energy, right? And we went through the various steps for that. Like what? Our song. Rejoicing, for example. Yeah, in your stuff. Dedication. Asking lamas to teach. Asking them to stay. Like that, okay? Positive energy. Collecting positive energy. Fourth chapter was called what? Carefulness. Okay. Like watching your mind, making sure that you're not breaking it during the day. Fifth chapter. Sheshin, which is awareness. Okay. What's the difference between those two? Jemba and Sheshin. What's the difference between recollection and awareness?
Recollection, you're remembering something virtuous, object, and awareness, you're being mindful, not virtuous.
That's partly it. That's recollection. What's the difference between recollection and awareness? Yeah, awareness is the alarm. Awareness is the alarm that goes off. So recollection is really just keeping in mind your goal. Like, I don't want to get... In the back of your mind, you're thinking, I have to remember that I made a promise this morning that I wasn't going to get angry in traffic. You know, I did it yesterday. I promised and then I broke it. You know, that I wasn't going to get angry while I was driving through New York traffic. And recollection means every few minutes I remember, oh yeah, I'm not supposed to be getting angry. Then what's the sheshin do? What's awareness do? When you start to get angry, it goes, you know, hey, you said you weren't going to get angry, and now you got angry. So sheshin is, awareness is the alarm. And recollection is just trying to remember what you were supposed to be thinking about. I don't know if recollection and awareness are the best words. Sometimes I think they should be reversed, or sometimes I think we should use other words, I don't know. Recollection, what we're using for recollection is keeping your mind on a virtuous goal that you had. And then awareness means becoming aware when you start to slip. It's the alarm that goes off when you start to slip. Okay? And that's the difference between those two. Maybe we'll find a good translation someday. Sixth chapter. Sixth chapter is the perfection of patience. Okay, I prefer to call it what? Not getting angry. Okay, patience for me. By the way, it does also mean to be patient in a traffic jam, or patient when you stub your toe, or patient with your boss. And it also means being patient in the sense of if you have to do something very difficult to be a Buddhist, you know, like if you have to spend hours memorizing or your knees have to hurt, it's like endurance also. It's like being able to put up with the unpleasant circumstances in your spiritual path, you know, in your spiritual search, that you're willing to put up with all the inconvenient things that come to you, okay? That's another kind of fourth perfection. Okay, what happened to the first two perfections? Sorry, yeah. I'm sorry, that was the third. Fourth? Yeah. Third was patience. What happened to giving and ethical way of life? Huh? Say again? I don't remember myself. Somebody better answer. Huh? Giving is in the last chapter with dedication. And what about ethical way of life? Yeah, I think it was in the chapter on carefulness. Really, that was what we covered last time. Okay, and that's how he covers the first two perfections. There are no separate chapters for that. Okay, chapter 7. What they call, yeah, I prefer to call it joyous effort. Rinpoche again mentioned Sunday, if you were there, Master Shantideva's definition. And he mentioned that it came in the form of a question and an answer in a single line. Tsung Kang Gela Troa O. You know, it was interesting the way he presented it, because he said, you know, if you think about it, it's a question and an answer in a single line. Master Shantideva, in the first line of that chapter says, Tsun Kang Gela Towa O. If somebody says, what is joyful, what is Tsumba? And then he says, Gela Towa O. It's being happy about doing good things. It's taking joy in being good. And he asks a question and he answers it in a single line. Next one. Chapter 8. Samten. Okay. Concentration, you can call it meditation. Meditation's okay. Okay, Samten. And by the way, if you're on Tibetan track, these are in Tibetan. Okay. Number 9. Wisdom. Okay. Mainly understanding emptiness, but also understanding the laws of karma, also understanding dependent origination. Okay. Number 10. The chapter on dedication. That chapter is so famous that it's often taken out and recited in monasteries as a separate, as a prayer. It's so beautiful that it's taken out and written and separately recited in the monasteries and memorized by people because it's so lovely. And when you get to it, you'll be happy. It's like basically just fantasizing on helping every sentient being in the universe with everything they need, you know. May no mother in child in labor today experience any pain at all, you know. May every being in the hells have a nice mist of cool rain dropping on them today and stuff like that. It's really beautiful. It's really nice. So that's a general structure. And it's still built around the six perfections, with giving coming at the end, and ethical way of life coming hidden in mindfulness and recollection, awareness and recollection. And then with all of the things about attitude or learning the attitude of bodhicitta coming at the very beginning, all the warm-up to getting that attitude. So that's the basic structure. How to warm up to get bodhicitta, in the sense of getting rid of your negativity and achieving all the positive things. And then next, how to take a commitment to bodhicitta, how to start thinking like a bodhisattva, and then how to go through the six perfections. And that's the structure of the Bodhisattva Charvatara. Okay? Did you have a question? Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I'm just saying what's special about it is as a work of beauty. I mean, it's just, sometimes like if you read Abhidharma, Kosha, I mean, frankly, there's only one beautiful line in the whole thing in terms of beauty, you know, what you call beauty. I mean, if you're a philosopher, the whole thing is extraordinarily beautiful, but it's very dry. As opposed to that, which, by the way, I'm not putting down Abhidharma Kosha. I spent 10 years on it and I memorized most of it. And it's fantastic and it's incredible. Okay, but the 10th chapter is something extraordinary. It's just, it's I think, a real expression of love in poetry. And it's just extraordinary to read something like that. We don't have so often in our prayers anything that long and so beautiful, describing all the different, you know, wonderful things that he's praying could happen to different people. And just to me, it's very attractive. It's very beautiful. Things you wouldn't think of. He's like, may anyone crying in their room alone tonight feel an arm around them. I mean, stuff like that, you know. I mean, it's just something special, you know. Okay. You really should know the definition of bodhicitta from an authoritative source, like Maitreya. Okay. And, you know, two elements mainly. And I think it's easy, the first one everyone gets right, you know, for the sake of all living beings. Which for you practically means what? In practice, it's all, unfortunately, all the people right around you. Okay. All living beings is, unfortunately, your workmates, your family, your neighbor, the people on the street downstairs that you don't like too much, the roaches in your own apartment that you have to decide what to do about. You know, it'd be much easier if they were out on other planets and galaxies. Like when you say all sentient beings, it sounds like that. But unfortunately, they're the ones right around you. Those are sentient beings for you. That's the first thing I think to keep in mind. It's extremely hard to be a bodhisattva with the people right around you. It's much easier with all sentient beings, you know. And you will never be good at all sentient beings if you can't do it with the people right around you. And that's all sentient beings for you. Second point, you know, I will achieve enlightenment for them. And I think if people really had bodhicitta, then they would be working very hard to perfect themselves. You know, that has a whole lot of implications. For example, you wouldn't be watching other people's practice. You know, we start this thing like this, and every time we have a bad thought, there's this little gang of people in the class, and we're going around like, start to say something and go like that, you know. And it's become a custom. And then somebody offered to do it for another person the other day. And it seems so funny. It seems so silly, you know. It's like, you want me to hit your head for you? It sounds like you're just about to say something wrong, you know. But that's what you do every time you judge somebody. You know, you're saying, I don't want to slap my own head. Would you like me to slap your head for you, you know? And it sounds funny, you know, it sounds silly. I think that's the first thing. I mean, you're pledging to achieve enlightenment. I mean, 99% of your focus should be on your own life, your own thoughts, your own behavior, your own speech, to achieve enlightenment. Secondly, you should be going after the heavy-duty virtues, you know. I mean, there's like three categories. People who say they're going to have bodhicitta and don't do anything. People who say they're going to have bodhicitta and do nice things. And then I think you got to be in the category of people who say they're going to have bodhicitta and then go for the heavy-duty virtues. And you know what they are. And you have to go after them. I think especially if you have bodhisattva vows, that's your big deal. You know, that's your big career now, is to keep your bodhisattva vows. If you have secret practice, you have to be going aggressively after the goals of that practice. You know, not just doing it, reciting something for a half hour in the morning or something like that. You're supposed to be doing it at least 6 times a day. And you're supposed to be struggling to the highest of your ability to reach the 2 levels, the 2 stages. And you have to know them very, very thoroughly. And then you have to devote your life to getting to them. And I think if you ask most people, what are the 2 stages? They can't even give a good answer to that. I mean, it would take a lifetime to study the 2 of them. If you are serious about bodhicitta, you know, if you know Maitreya's definition, you've got to be going after those things aggressively, you know, trying to reach those 2 stages. That is the ball game for us, if you want to do it before you die. What I'm trying to say is the fastest way, if you're serious about this definition, is to learn that path and to aggressively go after it, and don't be wishy-washy about it, you know. Okay, learn both stages, go after them. Okay. There's a question about why the karma of bodhicitta would lead to a Buddha paradise, and you have to think about that. Okay. There's certain details about bodhicitta that make it the most powerful way to get to a Buddha paradise. Rinpoche mentioned it on Sunday, if you were there. It was like 1 second of true love or true loving kindness is worth thousands of years of certain kinds of offerings, you know, and he talked about that, and it's not an exaggeration. But why? You know, and I think especially, you know, what's the difference between the bodhicitta and the kind of love which is described in the Abhidharma Kosha, for example, which is a Hinayana text? you know, there are four kinds of love described in the Abhidharma Kosha, and they do not as effectively and efficiently create a Buddha paradise. Why? What's that?
Motivation.
They said personal responsibility and motivation, but that's not all. Something else. They are not Seme. They're not even called Semeshi. They're not even called the four immeasurables. They're called Tsangben Neshi. You know, the four states of Brahma. The four states of the Pure One. Why? It's the four same things, but it doesn't get the name immeasurable. Because it's not for all living beings. It's not focused on all living beings. Okay? There's a limit to the focus. If you want your Buddha paradise to be 10% pure and 90% defective, then just have bodhicitta for 10% of people and not 90% and not 100% of living beings. And that's the difference. It's scope. In the back of your mind has to be, yeah, for me all sentient beings is the people right around me. But ultimately I'm working for all living beings. And in the back of your mind is all the people on Pluto and Neptune and Saturn and everything else, okay? It talks about the highest objects of making the practice of offerings. Like, what are the highest objects towards whom you could give offerings? It's the three jewels. And later on in the final, it says, what's the big deal about the three jewels? You know, why are they so powerful? And how do you make an offering to the three jewels? Okay? How do you make an offering to the state of mind which sees emptiness directly? Now, how do you offer a loose schoolboy's cookie to the state of mind that perceives emptiness directly? Okay? You have to think about it. Right? And what does it mean when you set out a cookie to the state of mind which realizes emptiness directly? Okay? Because that's what you're doing when you offer to the three jewels. They can't eat it anyway. Okay. I mean, I guess an Arya could eat it. Okay, that's about it. Only one of the three jewels can eat anything. I guess they get everything. All right. Okay, you have to think about that. You have to know what the three jewels are. Okay. It talks about the three general types of offering. Okay. Anybody got any of them? Offering of things that nobody owns. And then? Offering your own body. And then offering things that you imagine. Okay. I was wondering the other day if things that you imagine and things that aren't owned are exclusive or not. This is the kind of thing we debate in the monastery. Are they? Can you... When you offer things that aren't owned, could they also be things that are emanating? I guess, yeah? Yeah, you could emanate things that are not owned, yeah? Yeah, yeah, okay, he's got it. But not everything that's emanating is not owned. Okay. I don't know. You can debate that. By the way, the thing about offering your body is oftentimes interpreted as your own practice. You know, offering your practice. Drupe chipa, you know, offering the success of your own practice. It's called tendupua, offering yourself as a slave of the Dharma, as a slave of other people. You know, like my whole day I will spend serving other people, you know, whatever they want, you know, I'm at your service, you know, and I don't have any life of my own. I'm just doing what other people need, you know, something like that. Yeah. I think it's that I'm running out of gas. Okay. Better? Okay. That's the subject of prioritization, which we talked about. You know, you don't waste your time. You figure out the most efficient use of your time. And that's not just a New York thing, that's a Master Shantideva thing. You know, he says, don't waste your time on small. It says one of the categories in the last class was don't harm your body for a purpose which is not major. You know, and like that, that you have to decide. You don't just give away all your resources to the first bum you meet. You know, you take those resources and you study them. You take what you need to live in an honest way. And then the rest of those resources, you figure out what's the most powerful thing you could put them toward. Like that. And you still keep some left over for the bumps, okay? All right, seriously. Obviously, you need to know the four forces. I always say there's only three things that we got to be interested in. It's how to clean out your old bad deeds, how to keep from doing any new bad deeds, and then how to collect ultimate good karma. I mean, really, our spiritual career boils down to those three things. Can you erase the energy of your past bad deeds? Can you stop yourself from collecting new bad deeds? And how? What is the most powerful kind of good karma that you can do? You can erase your old bad deeds by using the four forces. You can prevent yourself from committing new bad deeds if you understand emptiness. Okay? And you can collect ultimate good deeds if you do bodhisattva activities and if you study bodhicitta, which Rinpoche went over on Sunday very eloquently. Okay? All right. Question. There's a question. I'm going to tell you a question. Okay? It says, name six different kinds of practices that can be effective in the practice of the second of the forces. It should be the third. Okay. It should say the third. I don't know. We'll fix it on the plane. All right. It means antidote. Name six good antidotes. And you know those, and I'm not going to go over them. Obviously, the most powerful antidote is studying emptiness or reading about emptiness, okay? Because if you understand emptiness perfectly, you will never again what? Collect bad karma. You'd be crazy to collect bad karma, okay? Which disproves the idea that if everything's empty, you can do whatever you want, right? Okay. What's that? Say again? Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we're using the commentary order, technically. Okay. I'll give you the order that I have on the answer key. destruction, foundation, antidote, and restraint. Okay. Is that right? No. I have 4 minutes left, is what she's trying to say. Okay. We're only halfway through. Why does he compare... How many people saw English Patient, right? Guy cutting his... getting his thumbs cut. That was so well acted, the way the guy pleaded in mind. And it's really the most powerful moment of the movie. What does that have to do with death? Okay, why does Master Shantideva talk about the punishment of having a small part of your body cut off with relation to death? And it's that whatever emotion William Defoe had about his two thumbs, multiply it times 1,000, and that's how every person in this room will feel at the moment of death. And don't think differently. Don't kid yourself. Don't think that after 40, 50 years of wasting your life, you're going to be able to pull off a poa at the last minute, okay? Impossible. Totally impossible. You will be scared worse than William. Go see the movie again. It's a homework assignment, okay? And you will be much more scared than that. And you will not be able to think about, you know, anything else. You might as well get it done now. Okay. You have to know the chronic disease that we have. Liking things in what way? Ignorantly, okay, and disliking things ignorantly. Is it wrong to like the path? No. Is it wrong to dislike your mental afflictions? No. What? No. All right. Five activities that help you collect positive energy. You know that. Four ways to be happy when you gain the two forms of the wish. And that comes from that verse. If you're not sure, check your tunduk, okay? Tengdu dakse jebuye mi si bale bato teri sa giri suke sa giri sa dakito. Etc. Okay? How does bodhicitta really help remove suffering? Okay? And in what ways does it remove suffering? I think it's important for all of us to know the definition of mental affliction. Because that's the enemy. You know, that's who you're supposed to be fighting. You're not supposed to be fighting with your friends or your boss or anything else. I mean, the only thing you're supposed to be fighting with is your mental afflictions. And if you don't want to know what a mental affliction is, then you have to find out. By the way, how do you do a reality check to see if you have any mental afflictions? See if your mind is peaceful enough. If it's not noticeably peaceful, you have mental afflictions going on. Okay, very interesting. You know, want to check if you've reached nirvana yet or not? See if you're happy. It's very simple. You know, if you're not feeling extraordinarily contented or peaceful or happy, you have a mental affliction going on, and you probably don't even notice it. You know, and that's a test. That's a good test. If you're not feeling noticeably pretty mellow, happy, then you probably have mental afflictions going on, and wake up and fight them. You know, they're just running around doing whatever they're running the show in your mind, and you're not even aware that they are there. But if you're not pretty contented at any given moment, then they are running around in your mind, and you didn't even identify it yet. You're not even aware of them yet. So you got to punch them out. Okay. I think this question is, you have to know the six primary mental afflictions, okay? I'm not going to bother you about the 20 minor ones, okay? And you do not have to write the 84,000 variations. Okay? Okay? I think it's very important to be able to explain, especially if you're going to teach Buddhism to other people someday, why the continued existence of mental afflictions is only possible because of a misperception. You see what I mean? In other words, if you didn't misunderstand reality, you couldn't have mental afflictions. Okay? I think it's important to be able to explain clearly to someone why the connection between not understanding reality and having a mental affliction. Those of you who are in Massachusetts, we went through it from a text by Maitreya in detail. We went through it in Indiana too, but nobody was there. Except me. And that's the... You should be able to explain to somebody that, you know, it's really the connection between your suffering and your ignorance. Be able to explain the six perfections and why each one leads into the next one. People often ask, why is that in that order? It doesn't seem to have any clear order. Maybe the last two. Those of you who were at the Friday night class, you know, Friday night, if you weren't there, all we did was just that we had an open discussion. And we said, when can you say that you have perfected the act of giving? You know, like, and specifically, if I try to give something to somebody and I fail, you know, like I try to make someone happy, you know, I try to give them a birthday gift that would make them really happy, or I try to give them some gift that is something I have that could be helpful for them, and I give them to them, and instead there's some terrible reaction, you know, they get angry at me, or they ignore me, or they say, I don't like that, or I wanted something else, or something like that. Did I fail in the perfection of giving? And why not? Okay, you have to think clearly what the perfection of giving means. Does it mean that you will never meet another angry person if you perfect patience? Does it mean that you'll never be in another traffic jam? You know, does it mean that you'll never get sick again and you have to practice the perfection of patience towards your own body? You know, and that's, you know, is there a distinction between external success of your practice and the internal success of your practice? And I think, I know that I tend to feel that I've been a failure in my practice of giving if not everyone around me is happy. You know, if there's one student who's unhappy, I tend to feel like, oh, you know, I haven't done a good job teaching. You know, there's one person who's really unhappy still and who really is not responding nicely. They don't seem to be getting happy about it. You know, they even dislike what I'm teaching or something like that. And then I feel like I haven't perfected the act of giving Dharma, you know. And is that true? Should I have that feeling, you know? Or even on the other hand, if I teach something with a bad motivation, like with pride, and everyone likes it, is that the perfection of giving? You know, conversely, you know, so I think you have to look into that. You have to think about that. Okay. Last page. I have to run really fast after this, okay? So please excuse. And by the way, we don't do prostrations at the end of a class because it means we have unfinished business between us, which is the rest of the Bodhisattva Acara. Okay. I think you should know at least six of the many occasions on which Master Shantideva says, freeze. Okay. Just freeze. Just shut up. Okay. I think it's important to know what makes an act of giving very powerful karmically. Okay, six different things that make an act of giving very powerful karma. And then finally, different ways of attracting people to the Dharma through material giving. Okay, there were three parts of that outline. And that involved a lot, and we talked about it Friday night, the idea of what you are capable of giving. I mean, you have to be able to judge your own capacity to give, and you're not allowed to go over that capacity. Okay? Until you're ready. You should never be satisfied, but it's like weightlifting. If you ever did weightlifting or jogging or something like that, or dancing, you know, if you try what Baryshnikov did, you know, the first day, you'll break your legs. And it has to be your goal to do that, but at the beginning you have to start with these little exercises and learn how to move one foot and then learn how to move 2 feet and then you build up to that. So it doesn't mean you don't go to ballet and say, one day I'd like to do that. But it means you can't do it at the beginning, because what will happen is you'll break your leg and you'll quit. And that's not the point. The point is to judge your ability very carefully, but to keep challenging yourself every day to do a little bit better and to be a little bit stronger at it, okay? And very steadily to build it up, okay? That's about it, I think. We'll take a few minutes. I'm sorry to go that quickly. Let's meditate for just a few minutes. Try to dedicate what we did, okay? We did 10 or 11 good classes. Am I supposed to do a spiel? What spiel is that? Gatsto spiel. It would be very convenient tonight if people are interested to again talk to Michael. We need to know, while everyone's still in one place, how many people to plan for up at Gatsto. We met with the sponsor there today. They're very happy. They committed to another year's helping with the maintenance. And we met with the town, and it's like pulling teeth out of a crow. But sooner or later, we'll get there. And so Michael needs to know if anyone... He needs to know specifically two things. People who want to book into a retreat that's already scheduled, because a couple of them have filled up. And so if you're interested, you have to talk to him about that. And then secondly, if you're planning to organize your own retreat with some of your friends... he needs to know about those, because we need the other dates for for other activities. So we might book those dates for other activities if they're free. Okay. So he needs to know those two things. Even if you think you might want to do something, let him know so we can reserve that. Okay. All right. So take a few minutes and dedicate the virtue of the class. You know, I remember the night we took the vow and everything. Think about it carefully. Dedicate the virtue, okay? Think that out of this class we'll try to produce a few bodhisattvas in this eon, okay? And just enjoy it. We did a really sweet thing. We did a very good thing. There's not many people in New York sitting and deciding the best way they can serve every living being in New York, you know? There are many good people in New York doing many good things, but to sit here and discuss, you know, the ultimate ways of saving people from death and old age and illness is very special. I think maybe you're the only people doing it at this moment in Manhattan, perhaps. So enjoy it, you know, enjoy the ultimate goal is that, protecting other people from death and suffering, this kind of existence. And it's possible. We can do it. We have the information to do it. It's just a matter of pulling it off. Okay, you know everything about how to do it, and now you have to try to practice it. Okay, so please don't move for a few minutes and enjoy.
Yo, well, I can't move anyway.
And just dedicate it. Okay. I'd like to congratulate. You for coming and that you work so hard, you know. It's really good. And it's really rare in the world. And it's good to have people like that. And I'm very proud and happy to be with people like that. Okay.